welcome to the Donnybrook Podcast. I'm your host, David.
I'm Amanda.
And John.
All righty. Good to be back with you lovely folks. We are broadcasting from our brand new studios.
Definitely a step up.
Yeah. So, to be real here, we've been broadcasting from the church. We've been recording at the church all this time. We decided to go legit. We got some sound equipment, and we are broadcasting from my home office, which is very cozy. We're kicking back in comfortable chairs with mugs of steaming hot tea. I have a Monty Python mug with Monty Python phrases like, please, this is supposed to be a happy occasion. Let's not bicker and argue about who killed who.
You know, it's funny because tonight at the dinner table, our children, so my oldest is 14, my youngest is 6. And they're in 2-year intervals. And we
John, you have a lot of children.
We have, we have 5.
So many children. My goodness.
We drive, we fit in a minivan still. We've entered this phase where we argue about anything. And so I showed the kids tonight the Argument Clinic Monty Python skit, which they loved. And for the next 20 minutes, all I heard was, no, it isn't. Yes, it is. No, it isn't. Yes, it is. No, it isn't. Yes, it is.
So. Oh, that's fantastic.
I love Argument Clinic. I started showing it to my first-year writing students when I was teaching at BSU. And now I show it to my class every year at some point or another.
It feels like it should be part of like every debate team's
curriculum.
Oh, yes.
Agreed. Of course, the Ministry of Silly Walks should also, just so that we don't take ourselves too seriously.
Oh, I love the Ministry of Silly Walks.
Oh, yeah. Look, I got a text.
Oh, with a bit of government funding, I think I can make it really silly.
Lady walks in with a tray of tea and it spills everywhere.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my goodness. Okay, forget the podcast. I just want to play Monty Python clips now.
That seems like a good use of an evening.
I think so.
Do you guys have, like, don't you feel like it's about a 50-50 mix of people who get Monty Python and people who don't?
I think that's totally optimistic.
You think it's
really
lower percentage?
I think it's more like 25% of people get Monty Python and love Monty Python. But it just leaves a lot of people cold.
I don't know what the exact percentage. There's got to be a statistic on this. What percentage of Americans get Monty Python jokes?
Well, now I'm wondering, like, what is it about the dry British humor and the sarcasm and the I don't know. Maybe it's just the taking themselves so seriously, doing something so ridiculous.
I think that's part of it. I think also. There's a real mix of just absurdity and intelligence. There's a lot of sophistication in some of those jokes. I mean, the whole idea of the Ministry of Silly Walks.
That's
is
not the
sending
one I
up.
Those aren't the ones I like. Just to be perfectly clear.
You just like the absurd. That's absurd.
I just like
absurd.
The stupid ones. Yeah.
Well, see, and I mean, like scenes like "Help, help! I'm being repressed," and you know, she looks like a witch. Or incisive commentary there. As well as just absurdity upon absurdity upon absurdity.
Well, my name's Dennis. Didn't bother to find out.
Come and witness the violence inherent in the system.
We are the Spanish Inquisition.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, we must wrest ourselves away from Monty Python.
Well, now
here.
I need to know where you got your Monty Python mug, because if I can't acquire my own, I'm stealing that one. So.
Well, I managed to get it from John for my birthday this year.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's from... is it from what is it called? The
Philosophers Club?
Yeah, something. The Unemployed Philosophers Guild.
Okay, so it's the same place that you got me my mug.
Yes.
My
yes.
wonderful First Lines of Literature
yes.
mug that I carry around at work every
yes.
day.
Yes. That, okay. Yeah, those two mugs. And then have we talked about this before? The other one that I can't figure out who it needs to go to, but they have a t-shirt that's called Pink Freud.
Oh, no.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. So if one of you...
if I have a psychologist friend out there.
So if one of our listeners ends up with a Pink Freud... t-shirt someday.
Yeah, if you are a psychologist and you can prove it to us and you are listening to this podcast, I will buy you that t-shirt. You are my friend now.
You'll just have to send in a picture of you wearing it.
No, that's gross. I don't want to wear the t-shirt and then send it to somebody.
No, no, no.
Oh, no.
You, the listener.
Oh, yes, yes, the listener. Yeah, well, yeah, yeah.
I think they actually have to come and sit down and do a guest podcast with us in order
to
get the shirt.
Chat with us. I like it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if you don't live in the greater Boise area, you have to get on a plane and fly here.
To the greater Boise area.
The most expensive t-shirt you've ever gotten. But if you live in the Boise area, come and visit us.
It might be nice and convenient.
Or if you're not even a psychologist and you want the shirt, come and visit with us.
Exactly. Speaking of listeners.
Are we that desperate? We're starting to sound desperate.
Oh, yeah. I guess that does sound a little desperate.
Speaking of listeners.
I think we've gotten mail from a listener or two.
Oh, yeah.
Recently.
Are you going to go pull it up, David? So shout out to Liz. We all know Liz.
Everyone knows Liz. That's
knows
like
Liz.
The touchstone of it is. Your social capital. Do you know Liz?
I think actually literally everybody in the greater Boise area knows. And really not even the greater.
And we don't even have to, most of the to United like, States you don't have name to, her.
Her last name?
No. Everybody knows who we're talking about.
Oh, okay.
I'm sure. Because we all know Liz.
Okay, perfect. What else, David? What else have you got over there?
Were you able to pull up Liz's email?
No.
Oh.
I'm looking for what percentage of Americans get Monty Python humor, and I'm having trouble finding it. Like, apparently it's a low enough percentage that Google doesn't know.
All right. Well, let's just put a pause in this thing for about 10 seconds here while I go find Liz's email. All righty. Welcome back. We were able to pull up a couple of listener emails here, and we're just going to give a little bit of response. So if you write into the podcast, hey, you might even make it on the podcast. Liz says, guys, it brings me so much joy to hear your voices here in Minneapolis. I have such great memories of you all. Thanks for doing this. It's a nice intellectual boost. Did you hear that, John? You're an intellectual boost.
That sounds like a Pink Freud t-shirt right there. That's what that sounds like, right?
All right. We have another email
Liz,
here.
Liz, I need an address. We need an address. Pink Freud will be on the way.
We have another email here from Paul. He says, I really enjoyed listening to you discuss current issues. I keep hearing different Christians discuss their different opinions of environmentalism and would love to hear you, Donnybrook, about it. Is this a real concern as part of Earth Care, a Garden of Eden mandate, where the American church will look back in 200 years and see we were blinded by consumerism and greed, similar to Christians who advocated for slavery 200 years ago? Or is this an issue that is distracting Christians from the gospel-centered issues and is a political distraction from left-leaning media to lead us towards socialism? Your thoughts?
Wow, that's a fairly meaty email.
It is.
I like Liz's, hey guys, it's nice to hear your voices, because that's very low stakes. I love the fact that we have an old friend that, okay, you're not that old. We're older. But we have a friend from way back who gets to listen to us. I guess, I don't know, that sounds really egotistical, but you know what I mean. Like, there's this sense of community over distance that she is still a part of our lives in a tangential sense, but we get that connection through the podcast.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
As far as the other question is concerned, I feel like we could probably dedicate an entire show
episode
to that question.
Yeah.
So rather than trying to wrestle with the whole thing without any preparation right now, I guess, is there a yes-no way of answering that question? So the question, again, can you
the question is, synopsis? Are Christians today that
is environmentalism a real concern?
Yeah, are Christians going to look back in 200 years and say, I can't believe we were ignoring this? Or in the same way that we look back at Christians 200 years ago and say, can you believe they advocated for slavery?
So I think slavery is a hard one to compare to, because that's one that is so black and white and so easy for us to identify with as wrong, as unequivocally wrong. So if we take that piece out of the equation and we just answer the first part of it, is environmentalism or is Earth Care a legitimate concern? David, yes or no? That's
maybe.
Taking too long. Amanda,
maybe.
Yes or
maybe.
No? That's not an answer. It's a
I know,
yes
I know.
Or no question.
I think that my predominant...
Okay, you're still too long.
Yes. For a long time, I thought that... No, it's not that important, and we should be focusing on other issues. I think that there's lots of people who say, yes, science definitely says we're on the brink of catastrophe. Lots of people say we don't. I don't see how there's ever going to be any sort of agreement on the science because people view the science in such different ways.
Unless a catastrophe happens, in which case it'll be confirmation of one.
Sure.
Particular.
Absolutely. Yeah. How's that for close?
That wasn't a yes or no question answer.
Okay.
That was very...
That's about all.
That felt like a roundabout way of you saying no, but I'm open to it being yes.
Yeah. So pretty much no. I'm not even really that open to it being yes.
Okay, great. Amanda.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. And my answer would be yes. I think there is legitimate concern. I would base it... So I don't know that I was able to ever give voice to this until I read some... At some point and realized at some point that all of Tolkien's Return of the King and the Shire being...
The Scouring of the Shire.
Mm-hmm. Being really his kind of take on conservation and...
And the problems with industrialism.
And the problems with industrialism, yeah. And that as a kid, I grew up on a farm. And I grew up with pheasant everywhere. And I grew up with geese everywhere. I grew up with birds of prey, specifically bald eagles, that I could see. It was somewhat seasonal, but I could see them every single day whenever they were around, whenever that season came about. And you go back to those same communities now that they're still very rural. They're still very, for lack of a better word, they're still way out, still the middle of nowhere.
That's the technical term, way out.
Yeah. I thought of another term that isn't as pleasant and I thought better not use that. So,
You mean you thought of something and you didn't say it?
I did. It's beginning to work that way in my life. It's an expression from my days with FedEx. Anyway, the point of it is that at least in my own experience, I've seen a change in.
Well, and for me, the clarity I have about it is partly about letting go of the media narrative of either side. I think caring for the earth is clearly a part of the creation mandate. And just a clear-eyed look at human flourishing involves significant care for the environment that humans live in, whether that's a city and you're talking about having a healthy, flourishing city with healthy communities and low crime rate and clean water, or whether you're talking about the countryside and space and farms and... whether or not the runoff from a farm is poisoning fish or not. The idea of paying attention to the flourishing of the whole system is, I think, clearly, unambiguously, a part of the creation mandate. And I think that it's just as unambiguous that a lot of our practices are very damaging to the environment in a physical sense, and that when we damage the environment, we are damaging the conditions for human flourishing.
So just a few thoughts and we'll actually, I think we really should do a full episode on this and actually come with some statistics to
and
the
research.
Table. And because I think it'd be interesting, especially David having a counter position, you're going to have to come with your guns blazing, but,
really Donnybrook,
really have a Donnybrook over this. So a couple thoughts. One thing that I do kind of rail against is that there seems to be an almost religious fanaticism by environmentalists, right, where the earth has no
mother.
Yeah. Mother Earth. And we are, and every action where we're consuming something is interpreted as rape. And that is a challenging.
So let's not go to extremes.
We'll go to extremes when we need to go to extremes, but if every single time we cut down a tree, it is being cast
right
as if
it, or open a mine or whatever. I mean, there's legitimate uses of the earth that are, you could say, damaging to the earth. Right. Boy, I feel like we could very easily just get into a Donnybrook here, and
But I think we really should do our research.
Yeah, and we probably should.
So sorry, Paul. We will get back to you on that, and we should plan that for two or three down the road and actually come with some numbers and thoughts. Right.
And I think that the things to think about in preparing for that or in thinking about that are thinking about not just the numbers, the what environmental damage has been done or hasn't been done, and what is the consensus on global warming or extinction of species or whatever, but also talking about the ways that the narrative plays out in the public square, because he referenced that in his question, whether or not it's, you know, power grab, scaremongering. I'm not exactly sure the phrasing he used, but like talking about the way that it's being presented in the media is, I think, a significant part of the conversation, because you can say that you're very concerned about care for the environment and mean something very different than what you were describing, like every act being characterized as rape. And it's much more than, I think, just balance, like you said, avoiding extremes. I think it's more complex than that. It's not like, oh, let's not go to extremes. It's like, well, be very clear about why we
think some really good examples, and there's some really bad examples of how to handle this. Like,
oh, and I actually think slavery is the perfect parallel. So,
oh, you do?
We can argue about that too.
Ooh, I think I'm probably the world's worst like Donnybrooker.
Slavery and like World War II Nazis have become like the ultimate evils in every conversation that we've
You can trump the conversation.
I see what you did there.
I didn't mean to do that. That was totally accidental. But like, you can trump the conversation, right? Like, what is Godwin's law? Whoever appeals to Hitler first loses. But I think that there's an economic, economics and consumerism.
I can see that.
And the immorality of the justifications of slavery are very much tied to greed and desire for wealth and ease.
For it to hold up, I think you would have to be able to draw a direct correlation that our misuse of the earth is clearly destroying life. Mm. Not just plant life, not just animal life, but the quality of human life. And maybe that parallel can be drawn. But that would be kind of the place that I would have to see unequivocally.
Well, it sounds like we need to do some really great Donnybrooking here.
I really
think I am the world's worst Donnybrooker, because I don't I'm here. I can feel myself trying to avoid a fight.
Right. Even as you.
Yeah.
You're like, I don't agree with them, but I'm not going to
kind of like see what you're saying. Yeah, I could kind of.
So pretty much I'm going to have to take up your position and fight against Amanda.
Look, if I take up an opposite position, I have to argue with you.
Okay, so I guess one of us will have to pick the
position. That's a Monty Python joke right there.
No, okay.
Hey, hold on just a sec. What is Godwin's Law? I've never heard of this.
You haven't? Have you ever been on the internet, David?
I have been on the internet, believe it or not, but I've never heard of Godwin's Law.
No, he hasn't.
I don't think you've really been on the internet.
Yes, I have.
I had to,
no, he hasn't.
I had to tell you about Reddit. I had to tell you. I feel like I had to tell you about the dark web.
Just ooh, tell and God Woot. Oh, I had to, and I, Woot. Way I had back to tell in the day, Woot. You told me about Woot.
I had to tell you about Woot, and I had to tell you about 4chan, yep. And all kinds of things that you're just cheerfully oblivious to.
Yep.
So Godwin's Law that, okay, I can't formulate Godwin's Law, but it has to do with bringing up Hitler in an argument online. And I think it's basically whoever brings up Hitler first loses. And or any it's, if it's any like conversation goes long enough, it will come to...
the lowest common denominator in every
who's
argument.
Who's Godwin?
I don't know. Watch, I have this all wrong. And I'm preening myself on my superior understanding of internet culture.
Well, I want to know, like, okay, if Godwin is a thing, like, who is he? And how did he say Godwin's
law? Lord Godwin.
Oh, okay. John knows.
The original formulation of Godwin's Law goes, as an online discussion grows longer, the probability of a comparison involving Nazis or Hitler approaches one. That's Godwin's Law. Okay. Mike Godwin.
So, and you see this all Godwin's the time. Law. Anytime a president, there's a discussion about presidents, they almost immediately, some troll will Hitler. Yeah. Well, Obama is like Hitler or Trump is like Hitler immediately.
Okay. If Mike formulated a law, I want to formulate a law. I'm going to be thinking over here about a law that I can formulate.
You can formulate your own.
Yeah.
You actually have to hang out on the internet to form a law about the internet.
I'm close enough here. I'm Donnybrooking on the internet. Well, I'm not even Donnybrooking on the internet. I'm Donnybrooking in a studio with cool people.
Yeah, and I think this other question that we got from Josh, we're going to have to push off to another. We're going to have a listener response one. Josh's question is related to the idea of divorce and whether the church should have a liturgical experience to end a marriage in a submissive way to the church. And in his scenario, he's saying he has a friend whose wife is leaving for several other men. And so that would be in keeping with the Matthew 5 passage of divorce is inappropriate except where
Moses
infidelity has been committed. How would somebody submit to the church and say, look, this marriage needs to end, but how do I do it in a way that is
some way
honoring the church
within the community of the church to acknowledge and grieve the end of the marriage, right.
which is assuming, I mean, that assumes that this person understands that divorce is a very serious and really a last resort.
That seems like a really interesting conversation too.
Yeah. There's a whole bunch to get into that. Yeah. And that's actually my buddy, Josh, he and I've had some conversations regarding this in the Catholic tradition of how to handle marriage and divorce and how
that's versus the Protestant, you know, we just don't talk about it.
Versus the, well, and we're also very scattered on how to handle the issue of divorce. So you've got, you know, uber conservative churches who say it's never appropriate, even in cases of infidelity. And then you have people who say, well, where do you fall on the question of abuse?
Right.
And can it be appropriate with abuse? And some people say yes, and some people say no, and some people say, well, separation, but not divorce and remarriage. But the Catholic Church has, they know what they think. Right. And they have, surprisingly, I mean, for all the faults of the Catholic Church, they have stuck to their guns on the issues of marriage and divorce and
But there's actually a current debate in the Catholic Church about the sacrament of communion of the Lord's Supper for divorced and remarried people. So that there's now
they've reopened it.
Not their rules on marriage and divorce, but their rules on then if you have been unlawfully divorced and remarried, can you come
and,
to the Lord's Supper?
And traditionally they say no.
Yes.
Yeah.
But then a theologian posited that you should leave it to their conscience. And so now there's currently a debate going on about whether that is an abdication of the authority of the church and introducing confusion and uncertainty where there should be clarity. So,
well, that's an excellent question by Josh. I wonder if he has a Pink Floyd shirt.
No, Josh wouldn't go for the Pink Floyd shirt. I know Josh. We'll work on that. Work on that. But no.
Okay.
I don't think that's his. That's not his style.
Well, so I got last about a month ago, I heard about this service called MoviePass, and I have no idea how this company is going to last. It costs $10 a month, and they will give you unlimited movies, unlimited theater passes. You can go to as many movies as you want, one a day.
So this does not seem at all sustainable.
Right? So,
I mean, if I joined up, they'd be making money because I go to about one movie every 3 years.
Exactly.
But if you commit to going to
one movie a month, you would make your money back. So I thought, well, gosh, I'll just try this out and see how it goes. I'm sure they'll be bankrupt in a couple of months. But
get on it now.
That's right. So I have, I got this and I've been had it for maybe three weeks, something like that. And I've gone to a lot of movies. I'll go late after the kids are down and just go, you know, a couple times a week. I've just been going out to see some movies and it's been so much fun. I kind of like going to see movies by myself. Just half the time in the theater, it's like a really late show and there's nobody else in the theater.
See, I love going to movies by myself as well. I just generally can't justify the time or the money. The money, of course, is a big part of it. But I don't even think with a movie pass that I would be able to justify it. Because seriously, I've seen two movies in the last 3 years.
What were they?
I don't know if I should admit this.
Oh, you didn't go to see 50 Shades of Grey, did
you? Oh, good Lord, no.
Twilight.
Oh, my goodness. No, okay. Mad Max Fury Road.
Oh, I want to see that.
And MST3K's live broadcast of the MST3K-ing of Starship Troopers.
I don't think there's anything at all embarrassing about any of those. Those are great choices.
Well, I don't have a lot of frame of reference. I wanted to go see Wonder Woman when it was in theaters.
Oh, that was a good movie, too. Then
I didn't have time, so I didn't. And then I thought, well, I'll catch it the next time I'm stuck on an airplane for 14 hours. And then,
which you do all the time.
Apparently. And then the last time I was stuck on an airplane, they didn't have screens in the back of the seats. You had to bring your own device, and you could download their free app and then watch movies on your device. But of course, I don't carry anything with a screen big enough to watch a movie on it. So I...
So you were out of luck.
I was out of luck. So I read and pretended to sleep for 14 hours.
So I've been watching... I went and I saw...
Twilight.
50 Shades of Grey. I mean, if you're going to accuse me...
Jumanji, which was lots of fun.
Gosh.
It's about these kids, nerdy kids that get stuck into this video game world, and the really nerdy kid turns into the Rock.
I'm gonna create a law right now called anything with the Rock in it lowers your IQ two points every time you watch.
I keep hearing he's talking about running for president.
Are you serious?
Not kidding.
Oh no.
Well, they're starting to talk about Oprah.
Oh my goodness.
I heard she said she consulted with somebody and decided it wasn't for her. She made an official statement.
Oh, she did?
That it's not in her DNA.
They all say that, and then push comes to shove, and they're like, yeah, okay, well, I'll do it. And I saw Lady Bird, which was a pretty good movie. And I saw...
Lady Bird's like one of the only movies ever to get a 100% Rotten Tomato score.
And this is a biography of...
It's a coming
LBJ's
of age.
Wife?
No. It's a coming of age movie. But no, I haven't seen
like
it. Yeah,
2002. This teenager living in Sacramento who's just kind of angsty.
Was it good?
It's very good. Okay. It's very good.
100% on Rotten Tomatoes. I guess. We need David's pronouncement.
Yeah, I saw Wonder, which I loved. Fantastic movie. Really enjoyed Wonder. And just the other night, I went and I watched Hostels. With Christian Bale.
Oh, you did?
I did, yeah.
After we talked about it?
Yep.
Was he good?
I loved it. Okay. Christian Bale and Rosamund Pike. And it was a really deep movie about these really broken people who were, Americans.
It's a Western film.
Kind of right at the end of when the Native Americans were getting moved off the land and they'd kind of lost the war. It was after Custer. And, you know, the Christian Bale character has just done all these terrible things, and the Native Americans have done all these terrible things. And then, you know, here's Rosamund Pike, whose family just, you know, got butchered. And how these groups came together and found some peace and humanity. Through the midst of their pain. And it was a really well-done movie.
I want to know is what percentage of your diet now consists of movie popcorn?
Oh, my goodness. You know how much it costs at Edwards for a small popcorn now?
What, it's like $4?
$6.79.
Oh, my goodness.
It's unbelievable. So, no, I don't buy popcorn.
Wait, you go and watch movies and don't buy popcorn?
Oh, yeah.
Well, he's going to more movies. He's gone to more movies in the last 3 weeks than you've gone in the last 3 years.
It's like
clearly more than twice as many.
It's like going to Golden Corral, right? Like you don't want to. Well, and this is actually what I'm wondering is when this thing
ends... You don't
ends,
go to Golden Corral. Just
well, right. I don't go to Golden Corral. Here.
Who goes to Golden Corral?
Somebody must go to Golden Corral.
Yeah, well, I know my grandparents did, but they well, passed away, open. So I assumed that Golden Corral went out of business.
So... when MoviePass goes out of business and I quit going to movies again, I'm not going to go. I probably wouldn't have gone to see all the movies, any of the movies that I've just watched, if I had to go and spend $10 to go see it. So would, is it, I feel like it might be cheapening the movie going experience. If I paid $10, if I paid $10, I'm going to really enjoy and treasure that time there at the movie theater. It's a special moment. But if I'm not paying anything for it, I am not valuing it in the same way.
Okay, so we just had the same discussion. So our family has a pass to go to the local ski hill, Bogus Basin. And we had this conversation the other day driving up the hill because we went skiing Sunday after church. And we got up there a little after 1:30. I think we got our first run in about 2:00. So we knew going in that we were going to get a limited day of skiing. And then on top of that, it's a school day the next day. So we're not going to stay till 9 or 10 o'clock at night. We knew going in, we're going to get 3, maybe 4 hours of skiing. Mm-hmm. And so there was a question about what is the number that you're going to set as what's the value you set on one run, right, or 2 runs or 5 runs of skiing, because you've got the time commitment of traveling up there and back, which is about an hour each way. And then you've got $5 of gas, give or take, for that, and some, you know, some ancillary costs. But the what is the value that you actually place on the experience monetarily? And can you place a monetary value on that? And I think we got one run in and we're like, oh yeah, this was totally worth it. Like, we could go home right now and we would have gotten
every money's worth,
penny of value out of it. Now, certainly you wouldn't have had that value if you'd paid a day pass, which is $67 or whatever.
For a family of seven.
$67?
It's crazy, yeah. So the only way to justify it is to go, I mean, to have this conversation is to have that family right. pass where you go.
Well, when I was in college, I got myself a season pass for that exact reason.
Right.
That there are times when you go up and, I mean, and I think it's so fascinating that you guys ski as a family, because we, with our much smaller family, decided a while back that it was just too expensive of a hobby mm-hmm. for us. We're going to wait until the boys are older.
I didn't know that you were a skier.
Oh, hey, I was a skier. I haven't for years now.
Well, we haven't either. So we decided this year, and essentially instead of doing sports this year, this is what we're
that's
doing.
What you do. Okay. Yeah. So, but when I got a season pass in college, that was my, that was what was made it enjoyable for me, because when I'd go and buy a day pass, I would put a lot of pressure on myself
right.
to have the right experience, to spend enough time. And when I had a season pass, I could just go up for 2 or 3 hours.
You could go, hey, it's snowing right now.
I'm going to
go catch 3 hours of powder, right. even though it's 7:30 at night.
Right. And I would, I mostly skied in the afternoons because I work too much. And so I'd usually have a morning shift at mm-hmm. my one job and a night shift at my other job. But if I got off work at the one place at like noon or 1:00, then I could get up there and then get back before I had to go to work. Mm-hmm. Or if I didn't have to work that night, I could go up after. Anyway, I just loved the fact that I didn't have to feel guilty for being tired or cold or not having a good time. Mm-hmm. And I could just relax and enjoy it. So I actually think that MoviePass would take pressure off. Like, I don't have to like this movie. Like, I can go watch a movie if I'm unsure of whether or not it's good, because it's not costing me anything.
I wonder if the better question would be, how much would you, David, be willing to pay for? You're obviously willing to pay 10. But if they came out and said, yeah, this model isn't working, we can't afford to do this, we need to charge 20. Would you still do it?
Nope.
Oh, wow.
No, because I would be happy to go see one movie a month, but I would not go see two movies a month.
I'd pay for them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you've already got, what, $60 of value in a month?
Yeah, because it's been...
That is so hypocritical.
But these movies that I've gone to see are not movies that I really enjoyed them and they were great. But I don't think it's a lifestyle that I would want to live long term.
But it's a lifestyle so really, you're living currently.
You'll, sure. So you'll go see a bunch of movies now. Yeah. But part of it is just your sense that this is going to go away.
Yeah. And I fully expect, even if it doesn't go away, I might cancel it in 3 months. Because I don't think I want to live going to 3 movies a week
for a long time.
Well, and there probably you probably have a little bit of a backlog of movies you're catching up on now.
I do. Yeah, there's been a lot of movies I wanted to see.
A lot of good movies that come out around the holidays and stick around in theaters. So.
Yeah. I don't know. I like the idea of so one of the things I dealt with becoming an adult was, and I think we all go through this to some extent, but I think about it a lot, that process of identifying what it is I really do enjoy versus what I feel like I'm supposed to enjoy. And that distinguishing of my own desires from social expectations and any mechanism for taking that kind of pressure off has really helped me just see what it is that I do love or what it is that I really do enjoy.
Like so, what mechanisms are you talking about?
So in this case, the price mechanism. So if we can remove the pressure of I spent $12 to watch this movie, I feel like I have to enjoy it. Or and this is much more what I would tend to do, I won't go because I will feel like I wasted money if I bought something and I didn't end up enjoying it. Like to an absurd degree that when I was in my late teens and early 20s, I felt enormous pressure to choose the right meal at a restaurant because if I pick the wrong thing, you're laughing at me, but...
No, Melissa, my wife's the same way. She's the same exact way, yeah.
Yeah, and so I had to consciously choose to give myself permission to waste the money so that I don't feel...
Right, if you don't feel like the meal was worth $24 just paid $24 for, it's okay.
Right. But then, I learned this much later, being able to acknowledge that the learning experience is valuable in and of itself was also a very good step for me. So any kind of mechanism that takes that pressure off or any kind of consciousness that allows you to regard I ordered the whatever and didn't like it is a valuable learning experience rather than a shameful, I got it wrong experience.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I think having a pass or something like that takes the monetary pressure off of it is really helpful.
Yeah.
Not that I'm going to get a movie pass because I still can't see myself having the time to, I'd have to give up too much book reading.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I think if the movie pass came with unlimited bottomless popcorn,
I'd be there all day, every day.
I'm probably in.
Yeah.
That does sound pretty good.
I love me some popcorn.
Well, the other thing is I used to go to Edward. Like I started out going to Edward's all the time because you can use your Edward's rewards card. And like every fourth or fifth time you get free popcorn. And then I realized that I could just go to the theater down the road and it only takes 3 minutes to get there. And I value that 3 minutes of just getting there quick.
Yep.
And the other thing I've realized is that I'll look and if it's starting to get late and I've kind of like maybe it's almost just started, I'll just go anyway and miss the previews because
who cares?
And I always loved the previews and now I've kind of seen the same previews and it doesn't matter so much and I'm happy to miss them, which I have never done that before in my entire life.
That's funny how that's shifted a little bit for you.
Yeah.
See, I still love the previews. Because we didn't have a TV growing up, except for the last couple of years I lived at home. And whenever we rented a movie, my dad would always fast forward through the previews.
Oh,
and so it was like watching previews was like, hey,
rebellion.
Right. I was so rebellious as a child.
I'm watching these previews.
Yes, these are my big sins. The time my parents told me I wasn't allowed to read that much and set a timer on my reading, and I used to sneak around. Yeah, I'd sneak books and hide in the house so I could read. And then, watching previews in the movies. I am very rebellious.
Ha. So Mary Beth and I went and watched Murder on the Orient Express.
Oh, how was that?
Kenneth Branagh and so many famous people, Johnny Depp and Daisy Ridley from Star Wars, and just all these star-studded cast. It was great. We loved it. We were driving back, and I was telling her, I read this when I was in high school, and I really enjoyed it. It was a lot of fun, but I didn't remember the twist.
Oh boy!
And so it was.
That's kind of a big thing not to remember.
Well, you know, it was a long time ago. Well, I had, so it was fun to kind of the point in the movie when I remembered. Oh, I remember what it is. but I remembered, and all of a sudden, I just start. I read this book in high school, and there was nobody else around that read books like that. I wasn't around anybody else that read like that. And I think that I kind of escaped into reading, into the kind of books that I would read. I read a lot in high school. And I think in junior high and kind of the first couple of years of high school, I kind of escaped a lot into reading and read a lot. And I think it was because I was pretty lonely and didn't really have friends. And I kind of wonder if that was kind of my thing to do, kind of the world that I escaped into. And I realized that the last couple of years of high school, I didn't read that much. And in college, I just kind of stopped reading. And as an adult after college, I didn't really pick it up that much. I still read things occasionally, but I don't read that much. And I used to read so much.
So are you saying you aren't lonely anymore, or that you miss reading now? Or I'm not quite sure what's the conclusion?
I think he's telling me I don't have any friends. That's what I'm hearing.
Are you saying that Amanda does?
Well, I wasn't looking at Amanda. So, but I
what is
I
the conclusion? If, land this plane.
Because when I, because I think the time that I kind of stopped reading was the time that I moved to Idaho and started making friends. And I kind of stopped reading at that time. And I wondered if for me, that was kind of the thing that changed in my life.
I think reading is very much a seasonal kind of thing. Mm. And even for a voracious reader like Amanda, I think you have times in your life where things ebb and flow, and like there are seasons that I can look back at where I read almost exclusively a genre of fiction or a genre of nonfiction, or was drawn to certain authors or certain themes. Maybe I didn't realize it at the time, but then I look back, I'm like, oh, I was a junior high. I was reading everything about lonely, you know, kids in
all the angsty stuff.
Yeah. The angsty stuff. And then you get into a different phase of life and you're like, oh, I'm reading everything about like the grays and the questions of morality and mm-hmm. ethics. And so I think, there is a season to it, a seasonality to reading. I think the other thing that very much has happened, and there's lots that has documented this, but we have very much lost the art of reading, and it's difficult to sit down and dedicate time to reading in our kind of helter-skelter busy world. I started reading more again here in the last couple of years, and it started with a class that I was doing through a local church with and we were studying Bonhoeffer. And they started us out not in some, they didn't start us out in like discipleship or life together. They started us out with some of his graduate level papers that he was writing, that were talking about like philosophy, and he's arguing with like
sledding.
Hegel. You're like, what the heck are we talking about here? And it was immersion or, it was immersion by fire of getting back into the habit of reading and being able to focus. But I very much found that it was like language. It's like that hard, if you can push through and the hard parts of learning a new language, you can get through that first level of remembering, oh yeah, this is how I do it. That this is how I read this, and this is how I have to focus. And then it'll come back to you.
Hmm.
But we don't do it very much. I still don't do it enough.
Well, and I totally agree with both the seasonal and the you have to adapt yourself to it, aspects of what you're saying. So, I mean, if there is a voracious reader in the world, I am she. Mm-hmm. I read over 100 books pretty much every year, sometimes well over. But I do go through cycles of reading more or less, and I tend to see a pattern of focus and discipline versus laziness. Now, most of the reading that I do is almost purely pleasurable. Mm-hmm. I enjoy reading the vast majority of things that I read. I don't like force myself to read things that I dislike, at least not very often. But there is a sense of discipline to turning to the book instead of doing something easier. I'm going to throw things at you. So like I've been in
I read Hunger Games 1 and then I just reread it instead of reading Hunger Games 2. And then I reread it again instead of rereading Hunger Games 3.
And you I must still have knew really the liked plot. Hunger Games.
No, I just I thought I was reading a new book, but it wasn't a new book.
Yeah, that is pretty much how it goes.
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah.
I read the first one and then I skim read the second.
Yes, exactly.
Two.
Exactly.
Like, but oh yeah.
Wow. Mm-hmm. How long did it take you to skim read the book?
I read the last two in an afternoon.
To pick the beneficial parts about 3 minutes.
Yeah, that was about it. So speaking of things that we read, though, I was having a conversation with some friends at work today and talking about just the practice of recommending books to friends and the different ways we do that and the different things that we mean by that. And I consistently have the problem of not having a clear sense of what other people actually enjoy, like gauging other people's taste by my own as a, you know, good egocentric person will do. I have a friend who was talking about his friend just enthusiastically and persistently.
Before you go any further. So like taste, gauging other people's taste by your own. So don't you feel like good book recommendation is kind of like food recommendation? You have to have a sense that certain authors are an acquired taste or certain authors are a taste that some people will never acquire. Like I will not recommend, my family has a great roasted Brussels sprout recipe. But I recognize that Brussels sprouts,
David's not going to
make people go crazy. And so it's not like I'm going to run around the world and say, we've got this great roasted Brussels. We got to try it. Like there is a high percentage of people who you say you can't even get, you know, all the syllables out of Brussels and people are puking in their mouths a little bit. So don't you feel like the same thing is true with literature?
Oh, no, I absolutely feel the same thing is true. I just I intellectually acknowledge that freely,
but you don't.
But in practice, I tend to just, I think,
bring on the Brussels sprouts.
Yeah. Well, not literally, but figuratively. Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, I acquired this taste and it's been so good in my life. So just push yourself a little bit and forget. And I do honestly forget that practice part. Yeah, that and the discipline part of it, maybe thinking about it like exercise, like I've been running long distance for a really long time. So, yes, pretty much anybody is capable of going out for a 10-mile run at some point, but you have to train up to it.
Right.
And I forget that. So, yeah, I try not to recommend books too often unless someone else brings it up. And I try not to push books on people like, no, you really need to read this. But this friend was talking about a friend of his who has just been pushing Patrick Rothfuss, Name of the Wind, unfinished trilogy on him and telling him it's the greatest thing ever. And telling him it's better than Tolkien, which certainly,
well, it's not better than Tolkien.
Well, right. So, and my friend is, I mean, Tolkien is top five all time for him. In fact, we were talking about top five books of all time, and Lord of the Rings was one, and The Silmarillion was two for him.
No.
So Lord of the Rings is totally the GOAT.
Yes.
Okay, but
so you have been on the internet, is what you're saying.
Did you see what I did
there? Yeah, I get that.
So you have to recognize that the person that you're recommending the book, if they're saying that Silmarillion, which is incredibly flawed,
it's dense.
It's a flawed. It's not even a book. It's a collection of thoughts and notes and
ideas and stories and poems.
Baron and Luthien is beautiful.
Some of them are amazing. Well, yeah. And
the creation story is good.
One of the most beautiful things that's ever been written.
But it's not the second. It shouldn't be on anybody's list. It should not be on anybody's list as number two.
As a personal favorite?
You can put it on your personal list.
This is the personal favorite list. So my friend...
It shouldn't still be on your personal list.
So then his friend is trying to tell him...
He loves Tolkien like that, but that's like saying...
But then his friend is trying to tell him...
The greatest movies of all time are Star Wars, A New Hope, Star Wars, Return of the Jedi, Star Wars... You know what I mean? It's like, are you really going to limit yourself like that? Like, have you ever watched another movie? Have you not watched Casablanca? Sorry, continue.
Well, okay. So, knowing that how much my friend loves Tolkien, arguing, and insisting that he has to read Patrick Rothfuss because it's that good. So.
And it's become a point of conflict?
Point of conflict in their relationship, to where the friend I'm talking about feels like it's actually like a point of tension, that his friend feels like he's being disrespected or dismissed because he won't. He hasn't read it. But then when his friend was like, no, it's actually better than Tolkien, it was like, nope, never mind. Like, if you actually think it's better than Tolkien, I'm not even going to listen to you. And then the argument's like, what, nothing could ever be better than Tolkien? Well, no, something possibly could be. But, I mean,
it just
really?
Hasn't been yet.
So far, all of the things people have said is better than Tolkien isn't even close.
Hey, that could be David's law.
Godwin's law. I was thinking about that too, yeah.
That while it is possible, theoretically, for something to be better than Tolkien, nothing ever will be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like the periodic table. Like, they posit that there's these elements there, but nobody's found them yet.
Right, right. Except that gets filled in fairly...
Well, that's the thing. I was talking to Cole the other day. We were looking at it, and I was remembering when I studied the periodic table.
It was smaller.
It was like there were all these empty spaces at the bottom, and there's no empty spaces anymore.
It's kind of crazy.
I don't think there were.
Well, a lot of unstable elements they've been able to temporarily isolate.
So land the plane. I'm.
Well,
I'm not following where we're going with this thing.
We're just.
It doesn't have to land.
We're just rambling.
we're refueling midair.
No, So I think about just that process of, does my enthusiasm for something, even if it's irrational, not that I would never argue that The Name of the Wind is better than The Lord of the Rings. Just for the record. But like, I love Gene Wolfe, and I try to recommend him all the time, even though I do that less and less, though, because I've just really realized that is not everyone's cup of tea. But
yeah,
is it okay to give that enthusiasm, in a sense, free rein, just for the possibility that it might be the goat for someone?
So really, what you're asking, or what you're talking about, is what are good rules for making recommendations?
Right. I mean, obviously, you should never be pressuring your friends to the point where they feel awkward about.
Well, it depends how good of a friend they are,
and how good the book is.
Yeah.
I mean.
Ooh, there's a correlation there. That sounds like another law.
Mandy's law: the better the book, the more you can harass your friends about it.
So I feel like there's a couple of things that are interesting. So one, like, you've recommended a lot, both of you have recommended a lot of books that I have read based off. In fact, the Rothfuss book was one, and I forget which one of you guys recommended it. But I imagine that if it was David, it's because Mandy recommended it.
Right. I got it from you, and I recommended
it to me.
Right.
But.
With the appropriate caveats that it's really interesting, but not.
Yeah, that's not a book for 14-year-olds to read. It's I think one of the things that is is incredibly important is like I take into consideration the person who's making the recommendation.
Right.
So in the same way that like I recognize that my palate isn't the same as yours or the same as David's, like you guys are both big Wodehouse fans.
Right.
Well, I don't get off on Wodehouse like the two of you do. And I understand that there are people who really, really dig Wodehouse. And that's not knocking Wodehouse. It's just saying, it's just me recognizing that I am not as big of a fan. But that doesn't like mean I don't think to myself I have doubts about your guys's
because of that one
choices. I just recognize that my palate doesn't extend or I don't taste that flavor in the way that you guys
right.
have sensed that. But I appreciate the breadth and direction over in general overall. I've read some Gene Wolfe that you've recommended. It's not my thing, but I'm probably a better reader having read
okay.
Gene Wolfe in the same way that I don't do sushi particularly. I have tried it and I will eat it again, but it's not like I get like super excited to go out and eat sushi. So I think that's really important though to breed outside of the context of
what you're totally comfortable
with. Comfortable with.
Right. Well, and the who recommends it is that's huge for me. I mean, I can't tell you how many times people are like, "Oh, you're a reader? Well, my friend's a reader," or "and you'll love this thing." Or
so a book that I often recommend that I do it to mess with people is Ursula Le Guin's The Left Hand of Darkness.
Wait, you do that to mess with people?
Oh, totally.
Because you think it'll counter their expectations in some way or confuse them in some way?
Yes.
Okay.
Because
I recommend that one because that's just some good literature.
Yeah, but it dabbles...
It's challenging literature.
Yeah. Well, so Ursula Le Guin is a great writer.
Yes.
And...
was.
Is she a was now?
Just
last
recently.
Week. Last week
oh,
she
no!
died. Yes. Oh, my goodness.
Oh, no.
I'm... Yeah.
She was the greatest living fantasy writer.
Yes.
Left.
Yes.
In my opinion.
Well, I mean, I would argue for Gene Wolfe, but.
Yeah, but you'd
he's
be
now
wrong.
In his late 80s.
So. Ursula Le Guin, but okay. But we can
yeah.
agree to disagree there. Yeah, no, I didn't know that. I knew she was getting
yeah.
close, but.
Yeah.
So that particular book, because it deals with gender
right.
issues and because it is. There is some thoughtfulness. It's a little bit more of a dense book, but it's a quick read. It's
right.
It's not a difficult read.
Yeah, it's not heavy lifting.
It's not heavy lifting, but it's heavy. You actually have to
you have
think.
To think. Yeah.
Yeah. So I will recommend that to people just to mess with them.
Okay.
And say you should read this book. It will make you think.
Okay. Well, and I love.
But
those
I realize
kinds
it's
of recommendations.
A palate expanding kind of
right.
recommendation.
I guess what I am bothered by, or I don't know about bothered by, but the thing that I have a hard time with is the...
David, have you read The Left Hand of Darkness?
I have not, but
David,
I do know who Ursula
really,
Le Guin is.
You should really read The Left Hand
have
of Darkness.
Have you read anything by Ursula Le Guin?
Nope.
Okay, you're off the podcast.
Yeah, we're done with you forever.
But I always saw
you've
the
been
Ursula
squandering
Le Guin
all of
books
this time.
When I would go to get the Madeleine L'Engle books when I was...
Right.
In junior high, I would see Ursula Le Guin, but I never got any of them.
Okay, yeah. So those are good books. You should read those. You
for
should...
book club, February, my book club, we're reading Tombs of Adowyn.
Which is my favorite of...
Is that the one to start with, or is Left Hand of Darkness the one to start with?
No. I mean, if you're just wanting an introduction to Le Guin, she's most known for the Earthsea series. That's her most popular, and it's very approachable. And so Wizard of Earthsea is the first one, and the Tombs of Adowyn is the second one, although you can read Tombs of Adowyn without having read Wizard of Earthsea.
Just read them in order.
Well, I'll tell you what. I am actually headed to Powell's here later on this week, so
no!
I'm going to pick some up.
Oh,
yep, do it.
Envy is strong. Oh, you should definitely.
Amanda just collapsed into a puddle.
I want to go to Powell's. It's been almost a year since I hauled
Powell's withdrawal.
Yeah. Well, and I only bought like 65 books last time, so.
So we're making this recommendation, so Left Hand of Darkness, and I'm going to tell you, like, it may not hit your fancy.
Like, you might not love it.
You might not love it.
Good to expand my palate.
It would be a good read. Yes, it'd be a good read for anyone to expand their palate. And it's important to try different flavors. And that's even a different flavor than the Earthsea books. Like, I had read the Earthsea and then I read Left Hand. And Earthsea is fairly approachable. And like fantasy, it's pretty much well within the bounds of the genre.
It's very well written in an area that is often very poorly done. So just her literary style is just excellent. But she does deal with more complex ideas than more complex philosophical ideas than a lot of fantasy writers do.
Yes.
And then Left Hand of Darkness is like,
as opposed to most
huge
fantasy writers
beyond.
Who are like, here's a dude. He has a sword. He gets the girl. The end. Yeah, more complicated.
So if we were to boil all this down to one statement, I think what we could say is different strokes for different folks.
No.
Oh,
I
this
won't.
Is great.
I won't. No. Oh, well, so what I'm getting from this is something that should have been obvious to me a long time ago, that recommending books is about a lot more than I love this and I want you to love it too, which is very much the fundamental impulse, but that there's a lot of it that's what?
No, I totally agree with what you're saying. I would say that the other part of it is like, I recognize, like, you have to know the people that you're making the recommendation to, and you have to, in a sense.
And part of that is knowing yourself.
Yeah. And maybe this is my pastoral kind of sensibility kicking in a little bit here, but like, there are people who I want to read. I want them to read certain things because I want them to be better people, right? Not because they're bad people, but because
they'll grow.
Yes. And if you only read within a certain genre, then that is going to produce
and I think this
a certain
is,
type of person.
My teacherly impulses are, this is good and you should know it. And so, and if you don't, then just try harder, which makes me a great teacher. But there is an element too of.
and you basically what you just said is, and if you don't get it, you suck. Is that what you just, that the other way of translating what
I
you
teach
just said?
I teach sophomores,
there?
So.
So it's rather sophomoric.
Well, I tell my class at the beginning of every year, there's a reason that sophomoric is not a compliment. And then they all look at me like, that's so mean. And then the next year they come back and they're like, yeah, you're right. But there is an element of, and I encounter this a lot in teaching, and I do teach, you know, classical humanities. So we do some heavy lifting in the reading department. There is an element of, you just have to submit yourself to a difficult text and give it your best effort. And you might not ever be able to make anything of it, but if you don't offer your effort to it in the attempt to love it and understand it, in the attempt to acknowledge its greatness, and it's something bigger than you, then you're, you know, what are you going to judge Plato by your standards or be judged by Plato's standards? So you may never be entertained by it, but generally when it comes to the great works, that they're sitting in judgment on you, not the other way around. So when I'm recommending something because I love it, I think it's hard for me to switch out of that mode and acknowledge that, you know, something I'm passionate about might not actually be great for everyone just because it's something that I happen to love.
I could buy that.
So make a recommendation for everybody out there. What is it?
Oh my goodness.
So we've got Left Hand of Darkness, if you're looking for something. So that's science fiction.
Very thoughtful.
Thoughtful science fiction
that'll
deals
challenge
with complex,
your notions. Yeah.
Complex social issues. What other recommendations would you make, Amanda? David, you're next.
Oh boy. Are we sticking with the genres?
No, let's get away from the fantasy.
Science fiction and fantasy
genre.
Okay. So not science fiction and fantasy. I think that it's incredibly important for everyone to read Pride and Prejudice.
Okay.
Insight into friendship and companionate marriage that is unparalleled in literature.
Melissa and I were just talking about Jane Austen the other night because we realized that there are almost zero significant female composers in history. And we were sitting back and we're like, well, there's Fanny Mendelssohn and there's Claire Schumann and there's Hildegard of Bingen. And we got home and we looked it up on the phone and literally that was the only three hits that I recognized
from
like famous female composers. But when you come to literature, you've got a wealth of female literary greats. And Jane Austen, of course, is one of the leaders of that group. So, yeah,
that's a good recommendation. And one of the greatest writers.
And men should
writers...
read Pride and Prejudice.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, I totally are you a agree. Human being?
No, well, I don't think many men read human... Jane Austen.
Right. Well, because there's this perception. Most men,
it's a chick story.
Yeah, there's this. That's the perception. Yeah, it's all about girls in pretty dresses, and it's all about romance. But, oh my goodness, the witty and hilarious social commentary is, that should just be appealing to anybody with a sense of humor. But what I think that she's most
but we like Jumanji. We want to go to the movies and watch Jumanji and The Rock.
It was any comments great, on that? Great way to spend 2 hours.
Oh my goodness!
It was witty and
yeah, but I think Austen is most valuable because of her moral and relational insight. So when she writes Mr. Collins, I mean, we should all be laughing at Mr. Collins because he's ridiculous, but he's ridiculous in a very particular way that is very human. And we all have a little Mr. Collins in us.
And we need to be very careful about that.
And we need to be reminded of how absurd we can be with our pretensions and our ego. And Mrs. Bennet, there's a little bit of Mrs. Bennet in each of us. And there is a little bit of, we have the pride and we are quick to judge other people and we're quick to think well of ourselves and slow to consider our own faults. So yeah. And none of us will be as perfect as Jane, of course, not Jane Austen, but you know, the character she wrote who is so beautiful. That's all anybody can ever say about her is that she's the most beautiful ever. And she's so virtuous that the only thing that everybody can say is that her character is just as beautiful as her person. And she's named Jane. So I think that worked out real well. But.
Yep. I am sitting here thinking, what am I going to say?
What are you going to recommend?
What am I going to recommend? I could go the Wodehouse route because it's just so much fun and such a delightful story.
All 90 novels.
Right. I could go the C.S. Lewis route, but that's just too easy, even though Narnia is just so fantastic. I keep coming back to George MacDonald.
I was just going to say, I bet you recommend Princess and the Goblin.
Well, I thought about that. I really like Princess and the Goblin, and I really like At the Back of the North Wind, but I think that where MacDonald was the most magnificent for me was Phantastis and Lilith. I thought that those the imagery and the bravery and the themes of humanity and just the very kind of abstract sense of beauty in those books was pretty moving and something that was I really enjoyed. All right, John, what you got?
No, I don't have anything else to add.
He started with
to
that. Who did you recommend?
Oh, The Left Hand of Darkness.
Yeah. Left Hand of Darkness. Yeah, just finished Watership Down. Everybody should read that. The Book of Dun Cow is a great book that I didn't know about for years.
Book of the Dun Cow is fantastic.
Yeah. These are all very genre specific. Both of those books are kind of genre.
Right.
Genre specific.
Okay, so break out of genre. The Supper of the Lamb.
I'm reading Silence right now. I would recommend that.
Oh, yes, yeah, Silence is.
That's a
probably the saddest book in the world.
That's probably true.
But great. Yeah. No, Supper of the Lamb.
The cookbook?
Yes. Yeah, I mean it's kind of a cookbook, but
it's
also
kind of a comedy routine.
No, it's like a theology cookbook.
It's very funny though too.
Yeah,
He's very, doesn't take himself too seriously with his recipes.
Nope, he doesn't. And I think that was the best book I read last year. It was fantastic.
Yeah.
So.
Well, all righty. Mm-hmm. On that delightful note, let's go ahead and wrap things up. This has been fun, guys. This has been a lot of fun. I'm David.
Amanda.
I'm an embarrassed-faced emoji.
And we'll see you next time.